On behalf of Andre Williams, may it please the Court. Since Ybarra was decided in 1979, it has been clear that reasonable suspicion must be directed at the person to be frisked. Nothing in Terry can be read to permit a cursory search for weapons. And that's exactly what happened here. Officers did not have reasonable, articulable, particularized suspicion to stop or to frisk Mr. Williams. This case began with a vague 911 call from an anonymous caller. At no point did the caller implicate Williams in any illegal activity. Unlike in Wooden, a case relied on by the government and the district court, the caller here didn't provide any description of Williams. The officers arrived on scene with a tremendous show of force, spotlights, an assault rifle, guns, but they couldn't even confirm when they arrived on scene that the group that they found was the same group that was reported by the caller. In fact, what the officers found contradicted the tip provided by the caller. There were 10 people on scene, not 25. They were in and around cars. There were no guns visible. No one was acting at all disruptively. And the most important part is that Williams himself was never identified by the caller and was not doing anything to differentiate himself from the group when the officers arrived on scene. This simply is not the same as Wooden, where officers were able to immediately identify the suspect who was the subject of the tip there. And unlike in Patton, again a case relied on by the government, Williams did nothing indicating that he was armed and dangerous. Nothing about his appearance at all aroused the officers' suspicions when they arrived on scene. He wasn't acting evasively. He wasn't making any sort of suspicious movements. He did nothing to differentiate himself from the group. He was simply standing with a group of 9 other men in a bar parking lot around bar time. They were all acting similarly, and no one was doing anything obviously illegal. This vague, anonymous tip cannot support reasonable suspicion, especially considering the fact that it was contradicted when the officers arrived on scene. Williams did nothing to single himself out, and this amounts to a search and a seizure based on a hunch, and that's simply not permissible under Terry.
Did Williams hesitate for a moment in showing his hands? Was that what happened here?
I wouldn't say it was hesitation. The officers arrived on scene, and one officer immediately singled him out, and the officer said, "Show your hands," and he said, "Why?" And the officer made it clear that this was not a question. This was something he needed to do. And at that point, Williams immediately showed the officer his hands and stepped forward towards the officer as the officer requested, so that the officer could begin to frisk him.
That's when the frisk began.
Yes. The frisk began immediately. Unless there are any more questions about the stop and the frisk itself, I'd like to move on to the sentencing issues. The district court misapplied and misinterpreted the sentencing guidelines for a total of 10 levels added to Mr. Williams' offense level here. Changed his guidelines from 36 to 47 months to 100 to 120 months. I'll begin first with the 6-level enhancement for assaulting an officer. And I'd like to begin by clarifying some facts here. The government argues that Mr. Williams assaulted a police officer by continually reaching for a gun in his waistband. But the record doesn't support that. There's no evidence in the record that he was reaching for anything, and there was no gun in his waistband. The gun was eventually recovered from his lower pant leg, and it's far more likely that the gun was in his sock or shoe or somewhere in his lower pant leg and not in his waistband.
If that's the case, Ms. Linehan, why was it that Judge Conley made reference to the fact that the gun was found in his waistband? Was that erroneous?
It was erroneous, yes, Your Honor. It was not supported by any facts in the record. And, in fact, later on we added the report from the police officer where he describes the exact location where he recovers the gun, and it was from his lower pant leg near his foot. So there's nothing in the record to support the finding that he was reaching for anything, number one, and that the gun was in his waistband, number two. Again, it was in his lower pant leg, and nothing Williams did amounted to aggravated assault, which is the standard required for this guideline to apply. The government advances two theories, and the district court found it based on two theories. Either he was reaching for his gun and that amounted to aggravated assault, or his resistive conduct, his noncompliance with the commands resulted in was assault. Neither of these theories are supported by the evidence. There's no evidence in the record that, other than being noncompliant, he did anything to harm the officers in any way. Anything about his behavior was at all harmful to the officers. He was trying to get away. He wasn't trying to harm them in any way. And in addition to the assault element of this, there also needs to be a serious bodily harm, or the assault was done in a manner creating a substantial risk of serious bodily harm. That isn't satisfied either. Nothing about his conduct could have put the officers at risk. He wasn't reaching for anything again. He wasn't kicking, punching, pushing, pulling. He did nothing to the officers that could at all be indicative of him trying to harm them. Under the district court's logic and under the government's logic in this case, if someone fails to comply with commands, in this case he took his hands off of his head and put them by his waist where they naturally fell, and then when he was on the ground, he refused to move his hands out from underneath him. Under this logic, though, the logic that the government uses, anyone would be subject to this enhancement if they are at all noncompliant while simultaneously possessing a gun. And that's simply not what the enhancement was made for.
So let me refresh my recollection. It's been a long morning here. Who testified about this situation? The district court heard evidence, right?
About the struggle itself? At the evidentiary hearing on the motion to suppress, there was a minimal amount of evidence offered to this. Just basically the officer who did the takedown procedure testified that there was a struggle. Other than that, there was no evidence presented at sentencing, no evidence, any more evidence offered at the evidentiary hearing.
The district court heard an officer who witnessed the situation.
The district court heard from the officer who was the one who ordered Williams to come over and then performed the takedown with the help of four or five other officers.
So it was the primary officer.
It was the primary officer, but he was there for the purpose of testifying on the suppression motion. So to the extent he said anything about the struggle, it was merely that it was a struggle and Williams failed to comply.
Did Judge Conley take testimony after Magistrate Crocker heard the motion?
No, Your Honor.
So basically, Judge Conley adopted the facts as found by the magistrate.
With regard to the motion to suppress?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. And if there are no more questions on that particular enhancement, I'll move on to the four-level additional enhancement that he received. This enhancement was applied because he was allegedly possessing the gun in connection with another felony offense. But there are two problems with this. First of all, he wasn't committing another felony offense. The government argues on two different theories about the other felony he was committing. Either he possessed the ecstasy in his pocket with the intent to distribute it, which is a felony under Wisconsin law, or he was resisting or obstructing the officer, causing soft tissue injury, which is a felony under Wisconsin law. He did not commit either of these felony offenses. He might have committed their misdemeanor counterparts. So he had ecstasy in his pocket, and yes, he was resisting or obstructing arrest. But the problem is he wasn't possessing the ecstasy with the intent to distribute it, nor did he resist, obstruct, causing soft tissue injury. So that's what ups it to a felony, and it needs to be a felony for the enhancement to apply, but there weren't no felony offenses here. With regard to the resisting, obstructing specific other felony, the reason it's not a felony is because he didn't cause, under Wisconsin law, the soft tissue injury that the officer sustained. And to go back to your question, Your Honor, there wasn't testimony offered with regard to this injury itself. We have the PSR, which discusses it briefly, and in the PSR, it talks about how the officer's foot didn't pivot correctly when he was attempting to do the takedown procedure, and this was a different officer than the officer who initiated the contact with Williams, So his foot didn't pivot correctly, and he ended up twisting his knee when he was taking Williams down. That was an accident. It wasn't Williams who caused that injury. That was something that happened, and it was an unfortunate accident, but not something that was done on Williams' part to cause that. So maybe if he had kicked the officer's knee out.
You're really arguing it wasn't the primary cause? Is that what you're arguing, really? I mean, officer wouldn't have been attempting to take him down if he hadn't resisted.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but if the officer hadn't been there that night, if he had called in sick or something, he also would not have suffered the accident. So under Wisconsin law, Williams' conduct had to be a substantial factor, at the least, in causing the injury.
Not necessarily the primary cause.
That's a question of Wisconsin law, maybe not necessarily the primary cause, but the fact of the matter is that here, nothing Williams did at all directly caused the injury. He didn't take any action with the intent to cause that injury. He didn't do anything to cause it to the officer. It was an accident.
Could you address... Go ahead.
I think we're going probably the same two places. I wondered if I'd like you to speak to this in connection with, but before you get there, aren't we kind of bound by factual findings on the ecstasy, that it was possession with intent?
No, Your Honor. Nobody ever made that finding. The district court didn't make that finding. The government argued that before the district court, but in fact, the district court said there's not evidence of possession with intent. There's evidence of possession, but not with intent. He did have four ecstasy pills in his pocket. Yeah. But the district court said that's not the theory that it was relying on.
Thank you for reminding me. Yes, that's right. I understand that point.
Where I was going was to ask you to address the government's harmless error argument on this adjustment, because it looks as though the district judge went down four levels from the guideline range after making this finding that you disagree with.
It was not harmless error. The district court had many things to consider at the sentencing hearing. At the beginning of the hearing, it said, because these enhancements are cumulative, I'm going to give you some sort of a reduction here. It might be two levels, might be four levels, but I'm going to give you some sort of a reduction. The district court then went on to talk about all the mitigating circumstances in Mr. Williams' life, the abuse he suffered as a child.
But did not say... in essence, it doesn't matter to me what the right answer is on this particular guideline adjustment.
No. The paragraph quoted by the government in their brief discusses, yes, the district court said, yes, I will be giving you a four-level reduction. It doesn't specify that it was for this particular enhancement because of a lack of clarity in the wording. That's not specified at all, and I don't think this court can be satisfied that what the district court said was, even if the enhancement didn't apply, I would still have imposed this sentence, because he was never that explicit. He never made it clear just how much of a reduction he would be giving Mr. Williams here based on the conduct.
Okay.
Your Honor's like...
Your time is... Go ahead. What is it you wanted to talk about?
Oh, I was just going to ask if Your Honors would like me to discuss the in connection with element.
With
more?
Your indulgence.
Of course.
I'd appreciate that.
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry. Cut you off there.
So the government didn't establish the requisite nexus here, and the district court explicitly refused to find that the gun was possessed to facilitate the resisting or obstructing offense. So to the extent that that's what the enhancement requires, the district court refused to find that. And that's the requisite nexus here. There needed to be some connection, needed to be possessed in furtherance of the other felony offense, and the government has presented no evidence to establish that.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. You'll have one extra minute for rebuttal as well. Let's see, Ms. Rumbelow.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. At approximately 11:30 at night, in a neighborhood that is renowned in Fitchburg, Wisconsin, for gang and gun violence, a caller placed a call to 911, not to the non-emergency dispatch line, but to 911. And very shortly into the call, she's mentioning guns. She sees guns displayed. And the dispatcher says to her, "May I have your name, please?" "Oh, no, I don't want to give my name." The actual CD of the call is in the record. She's afraid. She immediately starts walking in the other direction. She specifically describes that she, in fact, unlike J.L., she was an eyewitness to this, just like the caller in Wooten. She was witnessing a large group of people who were hollering and yelling at each other, brandishing 3 to 4 handguns in the neighborhood. Throughout the call, she repeatedly tells the dispatcher, "Send the police here. I live in Fitchburg. I know Fitchburg. The police need to come. They need to show up."
Did she describe criminal conduct?
Brandishing firearms at each other. They're hollering and yelling.
The caller was specifically asked whether anybody was threatening anyone and
right.
said no.
As far as she could tell, because she chose to walk away. She didn't want to remain in the area. Brandishing loaded firearms.
What constitutes brandishing in Wisconsin?
Brandishing, waving it about, and that's kind of what she described. She goes, they got guns
just,
out.
Just waving it about constitutes brandishing?
That's brandishing. If you think, my best response to that, Your Honor, is an analogy to, let's say, 924C. When we have to satisfy the element of brandishing in a 924C yeah. count using a gun, brandishing is just holding it out or, yeah, brandishing a gun. It's making it visible.
In connection with a robbery or some other crime
that would be
violence,
in a 924C. But
describing could be could describe conduct at a gun show.
That's not what the caller was reporting.
No, it's not, but a group of people, loud voices, guns that people, as far as we know, were entitled to possess.
They weren't.
As it turned out, yes, I agree. But
talking about handguns, she's like, I'm calling. The police need to bring people. You need to come through the area. This woman, who is familiar with the neighborhood, lives there, was seeing what she was seeing, was so distraught, she didn't want to provide her name. And that, I think the district court was correct in describing it as an ongoing emergency. The Wooten case is very clear. The court doesn't have to try, or the police don't have to try to show up, ascertain the identity of the caller first.
That's clear, but I mean, what was described in Wooten by the caller was a gun being used to threaten in a domestic quarrel, right? Which we know is an explosive situation.
And
we've
so
got to draw very, very fine lines in these cases if the Fourth Amendment and Terry aren't going to wind up disappearing altogether.
Well, Wooten described an argument and that the guy had the gun out.
I seen him pull it out.
Didn't say he didn't even talk about waving it around, brandishing it, pointing it. Just they were arguing. Seen him pull a gun out of a holster.
Ms. Rumbelow, let me just ask you, in your view, would the officers have been entitled to frisk everybody they found in the parking lot?
They did.
They did. Okay.
Did.
You think
and
they were?
A second gun was found under a car, and Mr. Williams was the one who still had his firearm on him. It's unknown to this day where the other third or fourth firearm ended up. But when you have, again, we have to, the case law says, look at the time of the call. Look at the neighborhood. It's the totality of the circumstances. And you have a large group of people. The transcript from the call, which was placed in the supplemental appendix, indicates that the caller, when you listen to the call, it's kind of fast and frantic. This woman is frantic, and the dispatcher wants to dispatch police to this. You know, it's like a mob action. You've got a bunch of people waving guns around. Were they going to engage in a shooting? You know, nobody knows, but considering this neighborhood, the time of night, the size of the group, an alert tone went off at the police department, and so the police immediately dispatched, you know, whoever was on duty, 5 or 6 officers to the scene, and they show up, and here, the dispatcher, I mean, it says that she did identify the race as it was a group of African-American people, and so they show up and they only see one group. 10 is still a large group. And then you consider when Officer Jessberger arrived, he immediately noticed Defendant Williams because he was between the cars, and Officer Jessberger testified. And we also have to take into consideration the officer's training and experience. And he testified. He knows that in a weapons call, and somebody with a weapon is going to have their hands down by their waistband, and that's exactly where Williams had his. Officer Jessberger did testify that he was avoiding eye contact. That was relevant in the patent.
Weren't the police shining pretty bright lights at him?
No, Officer Hale was the one who had the lights and the assault rifle, but he was focused on other members of the crowd. Officer Jessberger was the one who solely dealt with Mr. Williams. And then he sees Mr. Williams kind of take a step back. And then finally he approaches. He did comply, finally, to a point. He did this. He put his hands on his head. But then the minute the officer put his hands down by Mr. Williams' waistband, that's when Mr. Williams started violently struggling. This was not... five officers couldn't make him show his hands, couldn't make his hands visible. They delivered knee strikes to him. And they eventually had to use a taser. This wasn't him resisting arrest. I mean, it was, but very violently so. He absolutely, positively refused to show the officers his hands. And that's why the struggle became so violent in the officer. I'll get to that when we get to the sentencing issue. But if you consider the scene, you know, the officers are told there's an alert tone, weapons, in a neighborhood renowned for weapons, crime. The bar that these individuals were standing outside was working with the Fitchburg Police Department. This was all part of the, you know, testimony at the evidentiary hearing, to close the bar early because of the violence. But this is what the officers knew. They show up, they see the one group in the exact location described by the caller. Was it as large? No. But again, would it have been reasonable for the police to just show up, go, oh, it's a group of 10, shrug their shoulders and leave?
Suppose they found two.
Then maybe that would have been unreasonable. But 10 is still a very large group. And when they show up and they see, you know, hands down, none of the group would look at them. They're all averting their eyes. They didn't have their hands out where the officers could see them. Mr. Williams certainly didn't. And then he was, you know, trying to take a step back, avoiding eye contact. And based on what the caller had described,
so
again,
you need individualized suspicion. He's armed and dangerous, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. When you show up and there's only 10 people and the caller described 3 to 4 guns, that increases the odds, too, of who's in possession of a firearm. And then with the behavior, with the placement of the hands, it's reasonable suspicion, less than preponderance of the evidence, as this court well knows. So when you consider the ongoing emergency, and look at the most recent decision of this court's in Patton, there it was a non-emergency call. It was open intoxicants, 1:30 in the morning. That's not an ongoing emergency. No information that guns were displayed whatsoever. The officers show up in a high-crime neighborhood, 1:30 in the morning. They see a group of individuals. Patton was not one of them. He did not have an open intoxicant in his hand. So he really wasn't doing anything, except this court upheld his frisk because he took 5 feet back and avoided eye contact with the officer. And the officer said, well, it's a high-crime neighborhood, late at night. He avoided eye contact and stepped back 5 feet when there was no allegations of weapons, nothing. And they could see the people who actually did have the open intoxicants in their hands. And in that case, the officer said, look, I'm showing up late at night in this high-crime neighborhood. I'm going to conduct a frisk before I stand out here exposed to issue the open intoxicant citations. So if reasonable suspicion is upheld in Patton for no guns alleged, Patton himself was not violating any law. He was not holding an open intoxicant. He's just in a group of people, and he takes a step back and avoids eye contact. If that frisk was upheld, clearly Mr. Williams has to be upheld with the allegation.
He was noncompliant and moved about 10 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
So I say we're splitting hairs in these cases. And in Mr. Williams' case, what factor is decisive? Are the police entitled to just frisk everybody on the scene, regardless of individual behavior?
When there is a report of an ongoing emergency, yes. Yes.
Well, I'm not sure that qualifies as an ongoing emergency, but... So Williams' individual conduct really doesn't make any difference here, as you see it?
No, he did. I mean, again, it's under the totality. It's I respectfully disagree. I think it is an ongoing emergency in a community where you've got people brandishing weapons at night in a high-crime neighborhood. You know, they could have averted a shooting. Anyway.
Agreed.
You know, it is an ongoing. So that's how they viewed it. And then you take that and you couple it with what they saw when they arrived. And Officer Jessberger testified his training and experience, which is what we're supposed to take into consideration, where Mr. Williams' hands were based on, again, it's a weapons call. He couldn't see his hands. He was holding them down here.
After he showed his hands, why didn't that avert the suspicion?
Well, at that point, Officer Jessberger, based on his training and experience, felt he had reasonable suspicion to conduct a frisk. And I think that under the other cases that this court has decided and the facts of this case support that finding. It's a frisk. And then the frisk didn't actually end up really occurring because of Mr. Williams' violent struggle with the officers. And I want to address the court's question. What Judge Conley found was that it was no wonder that the gun eventually wasn't recovered from his waistband. What Judge Conley said was, yeah, you can supplement the record and put this report in the record if you want, but it's irrelevant because the violent struggle, in Judge Conley's view, resulted in the firearm eventually, you know, being displaced and moving down Mr. Williams' pants, which, based on the fact that Officer Jessberger testified that Mr. Williams was holding his hands by his waistband in his pockets, that makes sense. And other cases this court has reviewed, handguns during frisk are more likely than not. They're in a waistband. You're not going to carry a loaded 9mm gun in a sock and think that it's not going to fall out. So that's the most secure place. And so the reason it was found down his pant leg was because of the violent struggle. He had to be tased. He still wouldn't show his hands. Judge Conley made the finding for the assault because the officer did obtain a torn ACL. And again, but for Mr. Williams' violent struggle, and he violently struggled because he had the gun, that's why Judge Conley correctly concluded that Mr. Williams' conduct in possession of the gun did present a serious risk of physical injury to the officers, and that's supported by the Robinson case. And then here, it really did result in the injury of the officer. I'm running out of time, but going then to the Section 2K2.1B6 enhancement, the four-level enhancement, Judge Conley did very specifically, this relates to the government's harmless error argument, the district court said, your counsel and the government's counsel have been arguing both sides of what is an interesting legal issue, and that is whether or not the gun was used to facilitate the resistance of arrest. But I've tried to consider it even without the 4 points, and in fact, I'm giving you the benefit of a 4-point reduction in thinking about an appropriate sentence. And then he reiterated again, I think this is an appropriate sentence, 70 months. So the court was very clear that this was the sentence, and he was also very clear that the 4-level reduction was not to be fine, but in connection with the 2K2.1B6 enhancement. He was just like, look, it's a close call, and so that's why he removed the 4 levels and said several times 70 months is an appropriate sentence. So even if this court finds that he committed clear error in applying the enhancement, any error was harmless. Unless the court has any further questions, I ask that you affirm the judgment and conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rebelo. Ms. Lennon, brief rebuttal.
Try to keep it very, very brief, Your Honors. With regard to whether anything illegal was going on, I'd like to direct Your Honor's attention to the magistrate's report and recommendation where he discusses the activity that was occurring and why it was not necessarily anything illegal. Pages 50 to 51 of the separate appendix. And then the government keeps saying violently struggled. It's because of the violent struggle and citing Judge Conley's post hoc finding that the gun slipped through the pants to in support of the fact that it was a violent struggle. There's nothing in the record that the struggle was so violent. Yes, the police responded forcefully, but this does not mean that the struggle that was occurring was violent, and frankly, the government hasn't offered evidence to show that it was. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Case will be taken under advisement.